Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and our live panel from the Linda in downtown Albany for this Thursday morning, the 19th of September, before a live audience. And you can tell they're a live audience because they do this. Don't they sound great? My goodness. Fantastic. Good morning and welcome all. We are very excited, as we've been talking about for the last several weeks. We have a panel today that is devoted to the issues around DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we have a live audience, and we have an amazing group of panelists who are here with us to talk about this subject. A subject that is, I think on the face of it, seems pretty straightforward, and yet brings with it a number of complexities that I think we need to work through as a group, not only in this room, but throughout our culture and society. So we will start here and do this this morning. Let me introduce our panelists to you. A reminder, because we're doing a live show, we will not be taking letters today via email. All of our questions will be coming from our audience, and we'll be doing that in our 10 o'clock hour. So if you have something on your mind and you just have to get it out, we're at 339 Central Avenue. So come on down. Welcome. All right, let me introduce the group. I am pleased to welcome Jay Holly, Director of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging at Together for Youth. Hello, Jay Holly.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome President, CEO of the McLean Collective, with areas of focus in equity, team building, and leadership. Kathleen McLean is here.
Hola, everyone.
Alfredo Medina Jr. joins us, Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, College Diversity Officer at Bennington College, formerly with the State University of New York at Albany. Alfredo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you
for coming back. We welcome Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association.
Good morning.
Hello, Judy. And Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Thank you very much for being with us as well, Nick. It's all wonderful to have you. As we tend to do in these broadcasts, and today's being no exception, I would just like to start off by getting brief statements from everybody about how they got into the subject and why they are passionate about it and work in this field. And you can really, panel, take that as however you want to take it in whatever direction. But I'm interested in what brought you to it and why it is important to you. So I'll begin with Jay.
Well, I started in this work because I'm a Black woman living in America. And it is impossible to be a Black woman living in America and not be aware of the impact of race and racism and sexism at a systemic level in our society. I come from a family of a long tradition of doing advocacy work, and so this was sort of a natural evolution in my career. I was really excited to be able to join the Together for Youth team and think about what it means for us to look at the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion through a lens that connects with the trauma that kids and families in our foster care system are experiencing, because there's a definite connection between trauma-informed care and DEI work. So that's where my passion lies.
I do want to talk a bit about that trauma aspect later on in the program. I think it's a very important thing that we want to bring into the discussion. Kathleen.
Well, I started in this work. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. Who's from Brooklyn here? Brooklyn!
Brooklyn in the house.
Yes,
all
Brooklyn
right.
in the house. And when I came to Latham, New York, I fast forward to having my four children. My daughter, Danielle, who is now 29, though when she was 6 years old, it was a very typical day. She went to school, and then she came home. She went up the stairs to the hallway, straight to the bathroom, and made a left into the closet and took out a yellow towel put the yellow towel on her head and started to swing her hair around. And I wondered, I said, what is happening? What is going on? And I realized that Danielle, there were no students in her class that looked like her teacher, no one at Latham Ridge Elementary. And I sensed to myself, you know what, I think Danielle is struggling with her racial identity. And that's when I started to do the work and do volunteer work and go into the school. And actually, all the books had only white students, so I got books with brown students and started to read them to the classroom. And then I discovered this book that changed my life, Why Are All the Black Children Sitting Together in the Cafeteria by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. And when I taught a course at St. Rose, that's the book that came. And I realized at that moment, if you are struggling with your identity, you can never become what you can become. And that's what brought me to the work is my daughter, Danielle.
Amazing. And it is such a personal thing for so many who are in it, and which is something that I found as we started work on this panel. I wanted Judy to come in this conversation because of the role that the media has in these issues and covering these issues, and especially the controversy over these issues, and of the importance of, I mean, we could take this from two ways. I mean, one, there's the actual DEI within newsrooms in this country, but also, which I know is something you work on, but also the fact of how we cover it as an issue at large.
Exactly. In fact, I've worked in local media for 40, 45 years, and what I've seen over those decades is a gradual awakening to the idea that the news is more than what a bunch of old white men in newsrooms think it is. And what we cover, how we cover stories, what we put on the front page, the voices we talk to when we're writing a story or covering an event, for decades, it was limited to a certain range of people. And what I'm seeing, because the truth of our communities is more than just what old white men think. And I see that changing, but it's not changing quickly enough. And one of the mechanisms to having that happen is to have a more diverse newsroom, but to have more diverse thought. Nowadays, we're having this incredible issue about DEI. Even the term has been is considered a pejorative in many instances. And so how the media covers the issue itself right now is so important to explain what it is, why it's needed, the impacts it can have. And just like affirmative action became a bad expression for many people, you're seeing the same demonization of DEI happening now. And I'm hoping that maybe we can shed a little light on it today.
Absolutely. Nick Rangel.
Thank you. I think I share a similar story to some of my colleagues here, that growing up as a Hispanic woman, I experienced quite a bit of complication around my racial identity. In middle school, I started avoiding the sun so that I wouldn't get too brown. And when I moved from North Carolina to upstate New York, I moved from a military community to a civilian one, where I was one of, I think, three Hispanic students in my school. And passing for white was always, kind of front of mind, and how do you do that, and how do you avoid being bullied? Nonetheless, I was called racial slurs throughout high school, and as I moved into the college and graduate field, I continued to hear comments that my success was an affirmative action move. I got that job because I'm a Hispanic woman, and at the same time, I have an invisible disability. I've avoided allowing it to have an impact on my work, and that has meant hiding a lot of physical pain throughout my entire life, and trying to bring stories about invisible disabilities, the intersectionality with my Hispanic identity, my identity as a woman, and bringing that to the workplace in my day-to-day work has been really crucial and very fulfilling to me. Now, as an executive director, I can bring that intentionality and I can bring those experiences, and it helps me see with a more clear lens what the path forward is to diversifying workplaces. Much of my volunteer work is focused on pipeline work for undergraduate students into professions like mine. I mentor young people, particularly women of color and LGBT students, on how to navigate these very complicated conversations and get into law schools and graduate programs. I have a JD and a master's in public policy, and I work very hard to bring more diversity to my field. As an attorney, so less than 2% of the Hispanic Americans in the United States have a graduate degree. Less than 3% of the attorneys in the United States are Hispanic. And in upstate New York, you will not be shocked to know that there's not many of us around. We're kind of these unicorns. And that needs to change. And it's not just a DEI issue, it's an issue for everybody. We have a growing Hispanic community in the United States. Hispanic issues are American issues. Hispanic people have been here for a very long time. Spanish has been the primary language for over 200 years in most of the country. So, you know, I think these conversations are really important, and sort of elevating or amplifying the importance of diversity in workplaces is, you know, very crucial for just a stronger workforce.
Alfredo.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that, Nick, because I think I'm hearing and I'm kind of reflecting on how I got into this work, I think about my own struggles that I had growing up I consider myself a mixed race kid coming, you know, and a lot of that really is because of colonization and trying to figure out who am I, right? Knowing that I'm from the Caribbean, but born in America, and my mother's side of the family tend to be more Afro-Indigenous. My father's side of the family are very white passing. And you're kind of trying to figure out, you know, where do you fit within the context of racial hierarchy in the United States? And it wasn't until I was in high school as a sophomore that I had a high school teacher, my first black teacher, who's teaching U.S. history, and he required that the class read Before the Mayflower by Lerone Bennett Jr. And in reading that book and understanding the transatlantic slave trade, I realized that everything that my family had been telling me about, we're not black and don't conflate us with that, we're indigenous, just felt like a big lie, right? It was this whitening agenda, I think, that my family grew up through the regime of Trujillo during their time growing up in the Dominican Republic. And they didn't realize just how anti-black they were being about themselves and the internalized racism they were projecting onto their son that confused me when I got to college. And when I finally got to college and I was out from under their shadow, I really began to sort of find my voice and to center my blackness as part of my Latinidad, as part of being a Hispanic Latino in America. And I wanted to ensure that in my commitment to higher education, because this is the field I've been in for close to 30 years, I didn't want undergraduates to go through what I had endured of trying to find yourself, of trying to find where you belong. And so I've committed my life to this work. I study it. You know, I ended up getting a PhD and did my dissertation exclusively on sense of belonging, particularly for Afro-Latin students. And so I think by the struggle that I have around DEI is this need, particularly for Hispanics and Latins, to always have to validate who we are. And that could get very draining because you're neither brown enough or you're ever black enough. And so I'm here because I want to be able to shed some light on that and just to be able to sort of be here to address questions that sometimes can be challenging and difficult to ask because it always feels like, is that the right thing to say? Or I'm embarrassed that I don't know that information. So thank you for having us here, Joe.
Well, thank you. We have about 2 minutes before we have to take a break, but I would just like to start a conversation, and then we'll break and come back and have the rest of you answer it too. But I'll start with Nick, because you're the one who said it during your answer about having these complicated conversations. And I guess I'm just curious, and this picks up on what Alfredo was saying as well. Why do these conversations have to be complicated? What is it? What are the ingredients that make them complicated, and try to extract
Because it's basically, oh, I want you to treat me like a human being. Okay. And yet it's much more complex than that.
Did you see the Facebook posts comments to this event? I mean, I think there's the complicated answer is that it's complicated, right? There's yeah. been, you know, many hundreds of years of systemic racism that is the core and the roots of how this country developed and how the laws of the country developed and how the Constitution developed. And I think Alfredo mentioned it, even within and among minority communities, there is a bias against blackness. And I'll just say that. And I think Hispanic families like mine have had some conversations around what is our real racial mix. And there's always tension around a racial mix that could have more blackness and African ancestry than, say, indigenous or Spanish ancestry. The best is obviously the whitest, right? It's the Spanish. And that comes out in conversations every single day. And today, you know, we're having a conversation about DEI, and the vitriol on social media just assumes that a conversation about the fabric of America is itself bad. And to get to understand why, you really have to look at how we became a nation, how we were colonized, how we were developed, how we were settled, and who was at the helm for all of those hundreds of years.
I want to give you all a crack at answering that question and talking more about it. First, we need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We are broadcasting live from the Linda in downtown Albany. It is a wonderful conversation on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Kathleen McLean, Jay Holly, Alfredo Medina Jr., Nick Rangel, and Judy Patrick make up our panel this morning. We have a studio audience. We'll be asking questions. We'll go to those at 10 a.m. and we'll continue our program after this news from BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our live broadcast from the Linda and our live panel discussion on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we welcome you to the program and thank you for listening on this Thursday morning. We went to break and we were talking to Nick about the why it is so complicated to have these conversations. And one of the things that Nick brought up was you know, just as an example of seeing the vitriol that you see just on social media when we posted that we were going to have this this discussion. It's interesting and alarming, actually, to read some of the comments. So I do want to bring in I want to hear from the rest of the panel, but then I also then want to talk a little bit about social media and how that plays into a lot of this. Alfredo, as far as you, especially on campuses, having these conversations of do you believe it needs to be as complicated as it is?
I don't know if complicated is the word that I would consider this to be. I believe it's more nuanced. And part of that is because there are certain things about my own experiences that I don't feel are as complex as people want to believe it is. I think they want to believe that because it makes it much more difficult to shake their own beliefs that they've been taught all their lives. So they run to say, well, it's complex. And what I say is, well, no, I think it's just that it's more nuanced, right? Because at times I find that the work that I do and the work that we all do here is that it's always having to challenge what has always been historical of the United States, and that is the black and white binary. Everything in this country is always within the context of the civil rights. And post-civil rights, we've seen a wave of immigration in this country. We've seen where we've made progress. And yet we continue to still see everything as if everything were happening 60 years ago. And there's still truth to that there's a lot that hasn't changed. As I like to say, to the work that Michelle Alexander does, right? There's the new Jim Crow. And a lot of that is that instead of having enslavement in this country, we see mass incarceration of particularly black and brown men, including women would arise in that. Or taking away rights because you're a convicted felon, or having to check the box that is going to keep you from experiencing social mobility. But a lot of that is nuanced because a lot of it is dependent on where a person comes from, what were their situations, what are the circumstances, how not to treat everyone as a monolith. And so when I have these conversations on our campus with faculty, staff, and students, the first thing I always say to myself is, I need to meet you where you are. I am not going to ever come into this conversation and make assumptions about you, right? Regardless of how you look, regardless of your lived experience. Because deep in there, I'm going to realize that you probably have your own traumatic experiences. There are things that you probably are carrying from ideas that were brought onto you by your parents and maybe others. And I'd like to give you some grace, unless you want to be blaming racist, and then I'm not going to give you any grace. But I try to meet people where they are. And what I do find challenging, though, in this work that we do here, even on college campuses, is that everything is black and white. There's no grayness. So I want to be very careful about when we use the word complex, it gives sometimes people an excuse to want to delve into the deep conversations we need to have because they're far more nuanced than they are complex. And they can be both. But in the end, what I'd like to do is to be able to contextualize everything that we do around DEI as opposed to just wanting to attack it based on what people believe it means to them.
Jay.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alfredo, because I think that nuance really speaks to needing to develop skills around having these conversations. I think one of the challenges, I think it's less a matter of complexity and more a matter of comfort, that we have been socialized to not talk about certain things, right? We don't talk about religion, we don't talk about politics in quote-unquote polite company, right? And so because this is viewed as a complex issue, it's something we don't talk about because it makes people feel uncomfortable. And heaven forbid we make anyone feel uncomfortable. And so there is a need to build skills around how to have conversations about the nuance, about the complexity, about the lived experience. And to create spaces in which we can bring those skills to bear, right? To create opportunities to bring people with different kind of lived experience together to hear from one another. So I think the opportunity to build skills is why this work around DEI is so important, because it continues to call us into conversation about things that make us uncomfortable, but that are essential in our business practices. We know that businesses that deeply embed practices of DEI are more successful in all the ways we measure business success, but only if it is a complete picture, right? So it's not just enough to bring in people with different skin color, but we actually have to talk about that lived experience that those people bring, those perspectives that people bring into the workplace. And for those of us who work in businesses or organizations that serve humans, right, understanding the complexity that walks in the door when a child or a family is coming in for services, that we have to take into account that lived experience so that we can provide the best level of service, so that we can address the trauma that they have experienced in ways that promote healing and recovery. And so the idea of the skills needed to talk about this is something that I think has gotten lost in the vitriol, in the name calling and finger pointing in social media.
Kathleen.
What you made me think of is a saying I say often: we do not play together, pray together, or live together.
Yes.
Therefore, we don't know each other. And Jane Elliott is probably 85 now. She's an anti-racist. She started this work when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and she had a third grade class, and she did the blue eye, brown eye study. And we know the IRB today, she could never do that, yeah. Right? The Dr. Medina, yeah. That would never happen today. And what she says is that we have all been indoctrinated and not educated.
Yes.
And therefore, there is that when I thought of the thing you said about socialization, and that's what Jane Elliott talks about. And when I think about skills, one of the things we do in my firm is we did this with educators, right? We've done it with many groups, so we did this particularly with educators. And we use this text, actually, Why Are All the Black Children Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And every single week, the participants would read a chapter of the book. Then they would come in, and we'd have a conversation for 2 hours about the book. The first 3 to 4 weeks, when you talk about fear, everyone was fearful because they didn't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or think the wrong thing. But as people began to have those conversations about racial identity, about privilege, about white fragility, about all the things that are connected to that social identity, politics, and, you know, enslavement, homophobia, people began to get more comfortable because that was my role, to give people the words. And there were times where I would say, ouch, right? And so that we would pause and we would say, that is not something you can say. That hurts people. And someone would come to the room and say, that offended me, that hurt me. But they have those conversations, and it's only through conversation we're going to heal, right? Why do we go to therapy? Because we talk, right? My background, I have a bachelor's and master's in social work. We talk so that we can heal. If we don't talk, we are never going to heal. So we must talk.
Judy.
So this is a wonderful platform to have those kinds of conversations, but social media is where most of the conversations are happening, and it's an ugly place. The discussion about the WAMC DEI form is a classic example. What comes out is demonization of the term. I almost hesitate to, I would almost advise people not to use the term, to talk about it in a more general way in order to facilitate the conversation, because right now, I would say 90% of the people in my feed are just blatantly racist. They're scared. There are so many myths out there about DEI, and it's one of the media's responsibilities to try to dispel those myths, to correct those myths, to approach them head on and explain what's wrong. But on social media nowadays, the facts seem to not matter so often, and logical reasoning doesn't seem to matter. But I think you have to keep trying and not give up. And many times on Facebook, you're inclined to not go there.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with our panel this morning. And then at the top of the hour after the news, we'll go out into the audience and hear from you. I assume you all have questions, or at least some of you. Yes, there are heads nodding. That is wonderful. We will go to the audience just after 10 o'clock, and we'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to WAMC's live conversation about diversity, equity, inclusion at the Linda in Albany. Our roundtable panel this morning with very special guests, Jay Holly, Alfredo Medina, Kathleen McLean, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel. And we are in front of a wonderful audience, and we'll go to them in just a few moments. So I was just looking, we'll take this as an example, and it is just but one example, and perhaps not the best example. But early on, after Joe Biden left the race and Kamala Harris started to ascend, and it was apparent that she was going to be the Democratic candidate, is when many, including Tennessee Congressman Timothy Burchett, who is exactly the same age as Kamala Harris, we should say, and has somewhat of a thinner resume, claims that because she is a woman of color chosen for such a high office, she is just another example of the kind of mediocrity that you get when you make a DEI hire. Kathleen, I will go to you first. I know this is a lot of the work that you do, and I mean, what do you do with that? Well, I mean, I know what I want to do with it, yeah. But what do you do with it that's constructive?
Well, I mean, I think we all heard it. It reverberated all over the land, especially with women that look like me. We are used to hearing those kinds of things. And how we deal with it is we just do our action and do the work and show up in our excellence. Because our work and our excellence is what's going to combat the lies and the vitriol that has been thrown our way. And so many times sometimes we just ignore it because if we had to fight every voice that said we are less than, we don't deserve to be in that space, we would be in a combative state all the time. And personally for me, I choose not to be in that place because it's harmful, hurtful, and it can be very painful. I mean, I know with Kamala Harris, I know when they questioned her identity, she made one statement and did not respond to it. I'm not sure if she responded to that DEI hire comment that was made. I'm not sure if she did make any statement about that. Though I think the thing is to, one, show action and do the work. Number two, can ignore it. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to just make this inflammatory statement. Everybody, really, most people know that is not true, that she is not a DEI. I mean, she went to law school. She has all the credentials. And you're correct, I think, what you had said, you know, about the lies that people perpetuate in our society about people that look like me. And therefore, we combat it with our action, our excellence, and at times when we engage in a conversation, we can do that. But sometimes people don't want to listen or hear. And sometimes it's better to be silent because then it causes more angst and fighting with someone. And some people, they're not going to change their mind. And so sometimes you have to pause, step away, and let them believe their nonsense and their lies.
Jay.
And so I really love that you're bringing into the, calling into the conversation, standing in excellence, right? That the idea of rising above the vitriol, rising above the mudslinging. And there's also a cost to that. So in her book, Weathering, Dr. Arlene Geronimus talks about the impact of living in a society where systemic and institutionalized racism is so prevalent, and that it physically takes a toll on bodies of color, right? It changes DNA, it changes our body's ability to respond to stress. It physically is impacting people of color. And so we see all sorts of side effects of that, of women of color being far more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. We see high achieving black professionals having shortened lifespans compared to their white counterparts. It's physically taking a toll. So while rising to excellence is an amazing answer, there's a cost to that. Uh-huh. There's a cost to being in a society where that is not just allowed, but is the norm, right? So what the congressman did was not unexpected, right? Nobody thought, well, gosh, I wonder what lovely things he's gonna say about Kamala. There's an expectation that as someone who stands in black excellence, that you will be the target of attack. And because of that, there's a physical price that is paid. So we talk about trauma, we're talking about the impact that it has on the body and the spirit. And so I think it's important that we continue to push back against the normalization of those kinds of comments and the vitriol that we've seen.
Nick, I wanted to add something.
Oh, go ahead.
When you talked about health, I was listening to a podcast, and it was talking about Black people who come from the Caribbean, African culture, and then when they come here, what happens is they, in terms of looking at white bodies and Black bodies, their health outcomes are the same for white people. Until they live in America, their health deteriorates. But they have the same health outcomes before they get here. The minute they get here, how it changes. So when you talk about health, that is a very, you know, it's documented.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that in the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I want to make two points. Is it was not only Republican lawmakers and electeds who diminished the qualifications of Kamala Harris to be the presidential ticket. And we were on shows to the lead up as people were calling for Joe Biden to step down. There were a lot of debates and discussions about who should replace him. And I was on the roundtable saying, obviously, Kamala Harris, she is the most qualified person. She's literally the vice president right now. And there was not a lot of support for that until Joe Biden endorsed her when he stepped off the ticket. So it is true that the conservative congressman made these comments publicly, but Democrats were making those comments privately. And I do want to remind people that the pushback on diversity hires is broad. It crosses socioeconomic populations. It crosses political lines. It is actually a very common refrain in pretty much every group of people. Actually, most people oppose the concept of affirmative action in the United States. So this is not a Republican-Democrat problem. This is a problem in America. This is an American problem. And I want to just step back and remind people that whiteness is a social and political construct. And so many of these conversations forget that there was a whitening of other communities who were initially, when they arrived in the Americas, were not considered white. Irish, the other half of my family line, was not considered white either, right? They just got to become white politically before my Hispanic identity has, right? So I think that's important to remember here in politics, that we have to be aware every day and diligent every day in every space. And I don't give anybody any extra leeway there. The other thing that happens with this particular commentary is that this congressman has to diminish and be dismissive of every single decision made on behalf or in relation to Kamala Harris in her resume, right? That means he is saying that she got into college on race and gender. She got into law school on race and gender. She somehow passed the bar exam on race and gender. She got hired as a prosecutor and then elected by the people of California on race and gender. What did he do? I mean, like, what does that mean, right? And every step of the way, I'm very involved in party politics. Party politics are very, very complicated. There are a lot of, I'd say, interest groups and stakeholder groups. There is not a universal or homogenous point of view in any of these parties. And the fact that she has climbed climbed this ladder, we have to highlight how dismissive and ignorant it is to assume that she became the presidential candidate because she's a woman of color. The absurdity is beyond me.
And also the implication that only heterosexual white men are qualified for such leadership roles.
Right, exactly.
So one of the memes that's been popping up on my social media feed is, it says something like, we need to stop hiring people based on their race. And and so my response when I see that on one of my friends' pages, I'm like, yes, we need to stop hiring white men because of their race.
Amen.
Yeah. Amen.
Alfredi, we have about 2.5 minutes.
First of all, thank you all for those responses. The only thing I'm going to pick up a little bit on what we were talking, what Jay was talking about regarding the tax that we take on when we strive for what we call black and brown excellence is really part of this fallacy that we have that in order for us to validate our success, we have to basically work ourselves to an early grave.
Yes.
I bought into this grind culture for a very long time. I'm sure Kamala Harris and many others in higher positions have succumbed to this, again, this story that in order to be successful, you have to endure a lot of racial battle fatigue, which is what we were just talking about, which, again, for those who are not familiar with it, that's a term that was coined back in 2008 by William Smith, a critical race theorist, that really wanted to understand the experiences of black and brown students in colleges, right? Because we're always constantly having to take a battle. And if we did, we'll literally lose our mind. We will go mad. And that is the tactic, is to make you go mad to the point that you then begin to take on this defensive posturing where it then allows people to weaponize it against you and say, ah, you see, now they're weak. And they will use everything possible to undermine us when we're strong, when we're weak, when we choose to be resilient, when we choose to be soft. It's always going to be one way or another to be used against us. So what I'd like to say is to not be responsive to it. I know I've already left Facebook. It's just such a toxic environment. And I don't want to activate my central nervous system by reading things that I know by one person who's a troller that is going to make me believe that everyone who's in this audience feels the same way, right? And we have to be very careful about how whiteness also has been operationalized to make it look like, hey, we're all in collusion together, right? All white people are together in this. This is the way all white people think, right? So I do ask that when these conversations are happening, I do look to my white allies and say, you know, I'm tired of always picking up this emotional burden. Are you willing to do some of this fight? Because it was your ancestors that created white systemic racism in this country and whiteness in the ways that it operates. And I ask and I lean on that because what I would like for Kamala Harris, when she does become the president of the United States,
Amen.
Is that Kamala gives herself enough grace and not buy into the DEI rhetoric and begin to embrace more black joy than black excellence. Because as black and brown people in this country, I always say this to my own partner. I want your kind of lifespan. I want white people lifespan, right? I want to know what that's like to be in my 80s and 90s and go biking and hiking. I have way too many close colleagues and friends of mine who have died within the past 5 years before the age of 60. That is the toll of racial battle fatigue on our system. It is psychologically impactful. It is physiologically impactful. And it does not allow us to bear the fruits of our retirement because we've taken on so much. So what I'd like to also say here is that we can't always keep fighting the DEI hire stories and false narratives. Part of our lives also, and it means that we have to embrace rest and recovery and joy, because that is something that has not been afforded to black and brown people here for centuries, and that's something that we deserve.
Yes. Amen.
Alfredo Medina Jr., along with Kathleen McLean, Jay Holly, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel. We will continue our conversation, take questions from the audience, but first, news with Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Linda before a live studio audience. Talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Jay Holly is here, Kathleen McLean, Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel, and Alfredo Medina Jr. We are not taking questions via email today. We are taking them from the floor with our wonderful audience and wonderful people who have supported this panel and went during the fund drive and got tickets. And we thank you so very, very much. Linda is from Saugerties, is going to start us off.
Hi, this is a wonderful panel. Thank you so much. I think part of the problem is that a lot of people don't really understand what DEI means. Could somebody, like in layman's terms, just explain exactly what it is and what the guidelines are?
Who wants to take the definitional question?
So again, First of all, thank you for that question. DEI and the way that it's defined is three tenets, right? One is diversity, which is representation, right? Equity, which is about fairness and just bringing justice to any issue. And inclusion really is about belonging. It is about feeling like, you know, when I'm in spaces where I may not look like you, I may not have the same lived experience as you, but you bring something to the space that makes me feel like this is also part of your home, Alfredo, right? That's in the best layman's terms I can explain. It's very simplistic. How we operationalize it is where it becomes a little bit trickier, because DEI is not cookie cutter. It is not one way of a framework that says how it works at Bennington is how it's going to work with Kathleen, or how it's going to work with Ray, or it's going to work with the work that Nick is doing through a Legal Aid Society. Operationalizing it is where I find that it both has its benefits and its challenges. And I'll be the first to say that I myself operate more as an anti-racist person. I'm anti-racist in everything I do. I use anti-racist frameworks, because what anti-racist does is that it takes sort of everything into account when we're talking about identities. What diversity, equity, inclusion at times does is that it allows for those tenets to be attacked separately, and it makes it confusing to anyone who doesn't do this work to see how they all connect with each other. So that's the simplistic way. I'm sure other people here do DEI work probably differently than I do the DEI work at Bennington, or how I promote DEI work through my own lived experience. But I just wanted to just give you a simplistic way of how to look at it.
Anybody want to add to that?
Yeah, and again, what a beautiful job you did of explaining that, so thank you. I think one of the terms that confuses people is the difference between equity and equality.
Yes.
And so we have been fed this myth of meritocracy in our society, mm-hmm. that everybody has the same chance, and everybody, if you work hard, everybody can succeed. And in fact, because of the systems of oppression that have been built into the way that our society functions, groups of people have been marginalized, have not had access to the same resources necessary for success. And so when we talk about equity, it is providing access to resources that allow people to be successful, which is different than equality, which is giving everybody the same thing. I was actually doing a DEI training yesterday, and we talked about if a client came into our agency and said, I'm having issues with transportation. And we said, well, here we give everybody a bus pass. Everybody gets a bus pass. That's equality. Everybody gets a bus pass, mm-hmm. right? But maybe I don't live on a bus line, right? So a bus pass isn't useful to me. Or maybe I have a car, but I just don't have money for gas. And it would actually be a better use of resources to provide me money for gas than to try to get me a bus pass, which might be more expensive. So equity is about giving people what they need in order to be successful, rather than trying to give everybody the same thing, right? And we think about that at a systemic level. What does it mean for us to really think about what are the needs that students have as they come in? Because each student comes in with a different need that they have. Yeah.
Right? And if I just want to add one other thing that I want to also help to sort of demystify about DEI, DEI has been racialized.
Yes.
DEI has been meant to, is a way of saying this is all about black and brown people. No, it's not. It's about every identity,
yeah.
including the identities that are all represented in here. At Bennington, I have many students who come to my office who are white, who may be disabled, who are trans, who are neurodiverse, and it's accessible to everyone. And what I do hear from times is say, oh, but I thought this was a service only for protected classes or minoritized groups. I go, we would like to honor the ancestry of people who have been oppressed and who face systemic racism. But in order to achieve equality is that we also have to make those services available to others, because what I do find is that when we demystify DEI and not make it racialized as something that is only benefiting black and brown people, we can begin to honor the identities and the ancestries of everyone who's part of this country.
Yes.
Next question from the four. I love our listeners. They're taking notes. It's so, so great. Hi, what is your name?
Oh, Deborah Fagans.
And where are you from?
I'm from Albany.
And what is your question?
Well, we work with children. We have an after-school tutoring program that works with children in the South End in elementary school, and our training includes talking about racism and poverty and how that affects not only our students, but ourselves. And so I really, really have appreciated everything that has been said up there. But my question is just slightly different, and that is why do negative things take hold so much more easily than positive things? When you look at a newspaper or you listen to the news, it's always what's bad that's going on, and we don't hear about all the good things. And so I think that helps spread this negativity in our country.
I think that's it's a two-pronged question, because, I mean, it does say that media only reports bad news. They don't tell you about all the planes that landed safely, right? So there's that. But your other point, which would be the part of the question that I think I want to focus on, which is why do we believe the bad stuff so much easier than we believe the good stuff?
So I want to answer that in two ways. The first is that the human brain is wired to pay attention to danger, right? To pay attention to what might be a threat. Because that's how we have survived as a species, is that we found out the things that were dangerous and avoided them. And so our brains are wired to zero in on what might be dangerous, what's a threat, what's bad. The other side of that, though, is that human brains are also wired for connection. That we exist as social creatures. We are not born with claws and fangs or super speed. That the way we have survived as a species is together. It's in connection. And when we lean into the connection, it helps us to avoid paying attention to the danger.
Right. Anyone who's run a news site will tell you that the crime stories will get a lot of clicks, the major club. But also what will get a lot of clicks are those human interest stories about the dogs saved from the, you know, the ice flow on the river.
The dogs and the ducks together? Oh, my God.
Yes. Dogs and ducks.
So, I mean, besides the ones not being eaten. Yes. So amazing.
So the lesson to be learned there is that it is those personal stories. It is, those are the things that connect. Too often newspapers in the past have just focused on the bad news, what the planes that don't land, for example. What we are coming to realize as we mature as an industry is the fact that we want to report the truth of our communities, which is the good news as well as the bad news. We want to represent what's happening in every neighborhood, not just in certain neighborhoods. We want to write the news that matters to an assortment of people, not just to the people who are building houses or going before the city council and asking for a variance. So I appreciate the fact that the bad news, the hateful things, do tend to get a lot of traction, but take some comfort in the fact that I've seen firsthand that those wonderful, heartwarming stories do just as well, sometimes even better.
Nick?
I do think that there is a belief, a widespread belief, that economic prosperity is a zero-sum game, and that if we have to share this pie with more people, that means there's less for me, right? And I think that comes up in affirmative action discussions. If I allow more people of color or more people with other protected class identities, then there'll be fewer of spots available for me, right? What I try to discuss with people is how DEI initiatives help everybody. So having healthcare policies that cover transgender care means that more people have access to hormone treatment that other people need, that isn't just limited to transgender identities, right? When I talk about work from home and flexible schedules, that allows primary caregivers to access jobs that would be more difficult for them to access on more limited schedules, but that helps everybody, right? Everybody needs more flexibility and benefits from a more flexible workplace. And so I try to couch what I would call DEI initiatives in a different language depending on who I'm talking to, really, but a different language that, you know, expanding these benefits is good for everybody. Having a workplace that is accessible to somebody with a mobility impairment actually makes it easier for everybody to access that space, right? And somebody with a stroller or somebody with their bike or whatever the case may be. And I think that is where we have this opportunity to shift away from the racialization of DEI initiatives and really explain the equity and inclusion part, that equity and inclusion is good for everybody, not just racial and marginalized populations.
Let's go to a question from Lonnie, who's in Albany, via Queens, if I have that right.
That's right, that's right. Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Ronnie.
I have to tell you, Ronnie is one of our board members at LASNY, and I'm so excited that she's been able to make it here. Hi, Ronnie.
Fantastic. Ronnie. And I said Ronnie before, and I apologize. Ronnie.
Okay, so first I want to just say I was kicking myself early in the morning saying, why did I commit to this? But I'm glad I did. I'm very glad because I'm always committing to something. My first thought first is that, you know, I still call it Twitter. I'm a big Twitter head. And sometimes I look and I see some of these commentators from like Fox News or something and always talking about DEI. And I'm looking at them going, Miss, you're a DEI hire. Are you freaking kidding me right now? So what, you know, what I see is that they have gone through different stages with it. First it was woke, then it was CRT, then it was affirmative action, and now it's DEI. They're code switching because they know what they really want to say. You know what I'm saying? So whenever I hear that, I say, I wish it would be more education around who actually benefits from some of these different terms that they're throwing out there. Because it isn't just black and brown people who benefit from affirmative action, from being a DEI hire. So that's my one thing. But what I wanted to ask more in particular to the journalists on the panel is, why aren't journalists, like, I almost throw shoes at Joe Scarborough in the morning. Like, why aren't they saying?
You're not the only one.
Why aren't they really explaining to the masses, like the lady asked, why aren't they saying to them who actually is benefiting from DEI? Because I see more white women benefiting from DEI hires than I do black women. So why aren't they really giving these explanations to people about that?
Great question. Judy.
Right, it's one of those issues that we need to cover. Climate change, what DEI means for our communities. It's and you don't see, I hardly see anything about it. You just see the vitriol. In part, it's because it's complicated, but the way to cover a complicated issue is with a concrete story, with to go and talk to people, real people, about real issues that are being resolved. And that is the way you can connect with a reader or a listener. I mean, it is very hard in this day and age of social media, and people want things on TikTok. I mean, that, to grab someone's attention and get them to read a long story or to pay attention enough, long enough to grasp a complicated issue like this. I mean, I think it's something that the industry, my industry, needs to take a far more in-depth look at, and especially because in this campaign season, it is something that's driving a wedge between so many people. So there's great benefit to attacking this as a real story. And it's not just a one-day story. I think it needs to be something that's covered over time. It's difficult to cover, but that doesn't mean we don't cover it. There's the easy stories sometimes are fluff and aren't worth our time. In this day and age, you see a lot of the Joe Scarboroughs, the cable news, they just repeat the political stories over and over again. Certainly, there are shows that can take a harder look at it, but it's just something that needs to be done, and it's not going away, and it's something we all could benefit from looking at more closely.
I got a question from Warren, but Nick, go ahead.
I just want to mention that affirmative action covers not only racial minorities and not only women, but also people with disabilities and covered veterans. And I think if we started saying the conservative movement against DEI opposes veteran affirmative action, we'd have a different response, right? And I say that as my mom is a veteran, my dad is a veteran, and we, for I think people put out of their mind that affirmative action supports and assists veterans, people with disabilities, women, and people of racial minorities in the same way, in the same policies, the same initiatives, but we only want to attack the racial impact of an affirmative action. And I just wanted to highlight that.
What branch of the service were you in?
Army.
Regular Army.
For how long?
About 4 years active duty and then a whole bunch of years in the reserves.
Wow. There's Nick's mom. All right, Warren is here. Hello, Warren. You're from Albany, and before that, Brooklyn, I believe?
Absolutely.
All right. Go Brooklyn, people are saying. So you have love in this room. What would you like to ask the panel?
Well, I also used to run diversity for the Army at the Pentagon as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Diversity and Leadership. Wow. So, Army folks, thank you for being here.
Nice. How did that go?
It was great under Obama, and then that guy from Queens came in, and the world sort of changed. The world sort of changed, but I want to keep it on the federal level, Dr. Medina. Thank you. Thank you all for your comments. This is a great conversation. But what you said earlier about DEI being non-racialized, I completely agree with it. But the question for the panel is, when President Biden came in office back in 2021, he issued a series of executive orders, mm-hmm. 13985 was the first one, which talked about racial equity as being a central point to all federal agencies. And since then, every agency on an annual basis has to submit a racial equity action plan. They've been kind of quiet about it in the last year or so, you know, as you can imagine. But I want to get your read on what you think about those executive orders and whether or not racial equity action plans should continue under a future Harris administration.
Great, great question. Who wants to?
I could speak a little bit to that.
Yeah. Again,
I think that our government, in trying to get things right, don't think through everything. So I'll give you an example. We saw what happened post October 7th last year of everything that's happening on a global level, but how it impacted colleges and universities around the issues of growing anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in this country, which has always been here. But the federal government's response to college administrators, particularly my office, is do something about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, do you have any resources or education for this? No, but do something about it, because you're getting federal dollars, and any type of federal subsidies means that you have a federal obligation to uphold the law. I'm happy to do so, and I will to the best of my ability. Can you give us some guidance? We don't got that yet. So we'll get back to you in about 6-7 months while everything's on fire. And so I say that is because I think that there's always good intention at the federal level about trying to sort of equal the at least bring some parity to the playing field, right, when it comes to representation and diversity. I think the issue that we have is that no one there is actually talking to the people, particularly the experts, on how to operationalize it and make it so it doesn't come across as you're filling quotas or that it's based, right? I don't know if ever people have always heard the saying, or I've heard the saying, right, that black and brown faces in high places is not going to fix the problems. Look at Clarence Thomas. So I'm just bringing this out here, right? That just because
you are in a
position of leadership means that you are what's in my best interest. I think where the federal government would probably do better is to begin to have conversations with leaders who are doing this work to say, what is your intention? Because if your intention is just to put more minoritized people in these positions, and by that I mean racial and ethnic, my thing is, then you're treating us as a monolith. And what you're saying is that your skin is what's important, not your lived experience. And so, but that's a conversation that has to be had with people, with policymakers who are open to having those conversations, because my fear is that we're going to continue to placate and just, again, to politicize race and ethnicity in this country and not go to back to what Nick is saying, is that we need to think about how this impacts all social political identities in this country. I don't know enough about that one, but I'm happy to even research and learn a little bit more, because this is the first that I'm hearing about that particular federal executive order. There's so many executive orders being passed that I couldn't keep up with them in the name of DEI. Some of them good and some of them just problematic. I'll give you one last example. This country has been fighting the conversations about reparations for many Black Americans. I know that there have been, since 1989, probably over 30 commissions that have been put into motion to study this. I don't know how much more we need to study this. Mm-hmm. So what did they do in 2020 after we witnessed everything that happened to George Floyd? They gave us Juneteenth. Hey, thanks for that day off. That's not really what we asked for, right? I think what Black Americans in this country and people of the Black diaspora are asking for is say, let's look at what reparations would look like. The minute you bring up that conversation, what it does, it says, hey, we can't have that. So let's give you something like a day off. And this is the federal government's way of saying, we want to give you something, but we really don't want to take on the heavy work of what it would mean to have deeper conversations about these executive orders.
Kathleen, we have about a minute. Anything you'd like to add to that?
I did read about that plan, and I remember thinking, I'm like, wow, this is a good policy, but I don't know really how it's operationalized. Macro, I see it, but how does it operationalize in the micro sense of it? And when I think of reparations, one of the things they did after 2020 is many organizations I was working with, they were doing pay audits, and what they found were Black women were getting paid less, and they would give them like bonuses and say, oh, you know what, in terms of when we looked at pay equity across the board, you are making $3,000 to $5,000 less than your peers in the same role, and they would just give them a bonus for that summer. And so I did see a lot of those conversations in relation to that.
Thank you, Warren, for the question. Thank you for the thoughtful answers. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our program. We'll have our last half hour together here at the Linda. We are talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we welcome you and, of course, keep listening. And you can find out more about our lockbox, by the way, wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning on DEI and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Our group this morning, Jay Holly, Kathleen McLean, Alfredo Medina Jr., Nick Rangel, and Judy Patrick. I want to go back to the audience for questions. I just want to bring up something that I think is happening that we're seeing fairly regularly now. And I would like the panel to just address it and let me know what you think about this. But because it seems to be happening more and more, Harley Davidson announced last month that they are going to ditch their diversity, equity, and inclusion goals. A move that comes after it faced pressure from anti-diversity critics on social media. In a message posted to X, Harley Davidson said it currently has no DEI function and has not operated such a program since April 2024. The company added that it has no goals to include DEI in the future. It also said it has no hiring quotas and no longer has supplier diversity spend goals designed to spread the company's spending out across businesses operated by people from diverse backgrounds. So how does we are seeing more and more companies do this, and we're seeing the backlash that we've been talking about throughout the morning. So what do we do about that?
Dr. Carol Anderson has a book called White Rage, and in the book she highlights all the different things. So whatever happens, whenever there is an advancement, there is always a pushback, and that is what is happening in our country. So this is historical. We had President Obama, and then we had a backlash. Donald Trump. That is completely what occurred. And so in terms of what other professionals who do this work, and I have been having conversations about a board I serve, Diversity Executive Leadership Academy, we are changing our language. We are not using the term DEI, DEIB, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, Belonging. We are using engagement, emotional intelligence, leadership. We are still doing the work, though sometimes we've changed our language for us to continue to do the work, because it's really about the work. And the language continues to change, though when it's become very hostile. And so that's one of the strategies that many in my profession have done, is we are using different language to continue to do the work. It's the work of humanity, really. Humanity in the workplace is the tagline that I use and so many of my other peers. And so what we do about it is we continue to do the work, we just say it differently.
And we're seeing it at the colleges and universities doing this
as
well.
Yeah, we're seeing, I don't know if anyone follows the Chronicle of Higher Education, but there's a DEI tracker to look at all the anti-DEI, anti-CRT legislation. And I'm sure that there's over 45 bills now that exist across the country. I do know that New York and state of Vermont, where I work, we don't have any of those bills, which, again, makes me feel good knowing that we are doing the good work here. Mm-hmm. I think where we are challenged is that we have to look at this and think of, where was DEI pre-George Floyd? There was no push for DEI. It was after that, not just George Floyd, but just countless other, and I don't want to list all of them, but there's just so many countless other black Americans that died at the hands of law enforcement who are unarmed, that it felt like virtual signaling. Look at us, we're good, we're doing this DEI work, when there really wasn't an intentional commitment to really get at the heart of what systemic racism is within their company and how to fix that. And so I'm not surprised at all. Seeing all of this, I'm like, well, first of all, ain't nobody out there buying Harley Davidson bikes. I mean, you know how expensive those bikes are? And I sure know, I don't know any black and brown friends of mine who are driving Harley Davidsons. So good for them. They want to do away with that. Great. In the end, how I look at it is this way. I think about where we are today, and I do believe that there are some challenges with DEIs in the way that we operationalize it. And I do agree that I don't know if necessarily changing the name or coming up with different language is going to be the answer. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that we in the DEI community have to have some hard conversations about why are some folks who started this and stopped this have decided this is not good for their brand. And then we have to have the difficult conversation around why did they start it in the first place? Is it about capitalism, or do they really care about diversity, equity, inclusion? And I always want to believe that when things start impacting your bottom line, that's when people start to show up. So again, I'm just saying I'm not sure that changing language at times is going to bring people there. Either they're committed to it or not. The one company that we could learn a lot from is Ben & Jerry's. They always get my money. Yes. And that is because Ben & Jerry has never strayed from their mission. If you go on their website, Ben & Jerry has been down with black and brown people since the civil rights. They don't mince their words on their website. And they use the words that will challenge people around white supremacy and what that really means. They didn't need to see an unarmed black man die at the hands of law enforcement for them to take that stand. Can we have more Ben and Jerry leaders out there? I don't know. In the end, I think really what it comes down to is some people just don't know how to operationalize DEI. And I think that DEI experts have a responsibility to help those companies.
John is from Troy.
Hi, my question is for those organizations, those smaller organizations that want to do the opposite of what Harley Davidson's doing, that want to move toward DEI. Can you recommend, can you point us toward resources, trainers, et cetera, to improve their DEI practices? I don't know if WAMC can help us with this, just to try to point us in the right direction.
You're looking right at her.
And there you go.
The Capital Region Chamber also has a list of consultants who do this kind of work, which Kathleen is listed on. And they recently had a really wonderful panel just last week on diversity. And if I were a person looking for a trainer, which I always am, I went and I tracked down all the speakers and connected with them on LinkedIn and have already started conversations. Okay, how do I bring that training into my workplace for the staff that I supervise? So I think those are two really great starting points.
Kathleen?
Yeah, and so what we do is we talk what, so in terms of our process, when we start with a client, we do initial consult, we talk to them for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and ask them what are they're looking for, their needs or their expectations, and it depends on what they want. So our work can be micro, and we've done work with Nick over at Lasny where we did some macro work where we did a gap analysis and talking to, doing focus groups, talking to leaders, and at times doing surveys to really understand the culture and climate of the organization. And this is where it goes beyond diversity, equity, and inclusion. In some organizations, we worked, I'm just working with an organization now in another part of the country, and some of the issues at this organization are psychological safety, are really things about gender, are there's some things about race, but those are not, that's not the primary thing. And so when you talk about being holistic, you know, Dr. Medina, and what you said, Nick, it's not only about race, ethnicity, gender. Many times it is about bullying and other things that are happening in organizations that are anti-human. So that's one scope of our work, is the doing that gap analysis and coming up with recommendations that may or may not include training. And so in terms of our work, people will hire us to do, some organizations hire us only for training, and that's when we'll come in and do trainings on unconscious bias and microaggressions, and training on engaging in courageous conversations, racial stratification and socialization, or what's in a name, like why don't we say the N-word, why don't we say other kinds of, why don't we say the S word in terms of people referring to Latinos? Why don't we say certain terms? And that workshop talks about those things. And so our work, we look at a, you know, a holistic point of view, and then we also provide executive coaching for people in the organization. So one client we're working with right now, there have been 3 to 5 people who've been assigned to our team who have made comments that are unkind, right, homophobic, racist. And so they'll meet with me or someone on my team multiple times to help them understand why these are things they should not say. And it's through conversation. They could be reading articles, they could be reading books about that. And so those, that's our work really in a big nutshell. We do the macro and the micro. And our goal, really, our clients have told us, we've been able to change. Some people have come back to me and said, Kathleen, I changed. One woman, actually, I'm like, you know what, I'll call her Susie. I'm like, it's okay, you can still have white friends. She changed her whole life. Literally, she has no white friends. She put her white kids in a basketball that's with black people because she has really intentionally changed her whole life, because she said, Kathleen, my life was so white, and I'm just seeing so much value in how I've brought in, you know, living in a predominantly white suburb, going into the city of Albany and intentionally choosing to put her kids so that he can play, pray, and live with other people that are not like them.
Dan.
Hi, my name is Dan Irizarry. I'm the founder of Capital District Latinos. I'm so glad that this panel came together. And I have a statement to make and then a question I'd like to ask. WAMC and the Linda are placed, are sit in a city where there are 10,000 Latinos or more. The signal reaches an area where there are probably a couple of 100,000 Latinos. And yet WAMC does not really have programming that reaches out to that community of significance. And so I'm wondering what the panel thinks about, since like charity, DEI should start at home. What is the responsibility of a station like WAMC, a public radio station, to provide representation in its programming, but also to be a significant corporate citizen, right, of the area? And how should it affect not only what goes on the radio, but the staff and the board?
So this is an issue a lot of, so this is an issue so many media companies face. They it begins with at the top figuring out, well, what do we need to do? In the newspaper business, we've tried for years to bring more diverse voices into our newsroom. 85% of the students enrolled in journalism programs in a U.S. university are white. The country is not 85% white anymore. And when I ran a newspaper in Schenectady, for example, 50% of the population in Schenectady was people of color. My newsroom was not 50% people of color. In fact, I struggled to hire any people of color. Part of what we need to do is to create an environment where more people of diverse backgrounds go into journalism, for example, and to give us the excuse that we can't find people to hire is not enough anymore. What we need to do as an industry is to have internships that pay good money during the summer, so people who don't necessarily come from affluent families can come into our field. We have student essay contests at the grade school level to bring more people into the industry. I think so. Just saying we can't find the people is not enough anymore. I think what you're seeing in radio, in newspaper, and television is an effort, albeit a first step, to try to increase those voices. But I also think that. It's difficult, I mean, I would say, to meet all the needs. But I think there's so much we need to do yet. You'll see some changes happening. You'll see some programming. But it remains a challenge. But I think it starts at the top, where you start to think about what do we need to do, what is our audience asking for, and what is the right thing to do. Sometimes it's not just, if you just did what the audience wanted, sometimes you would just play classical music all day or something like that.
That's one option, sure. That's one.
But you have to feed the people the spinach as well as the you have to feed them as well as the cotton candy. So.
Well, the only thing I would add is I've worked actually with Dan when Dan founded the CDL, and I know one of the things that we were grappling with at the University at Albany is that we had many Hispanic Latin students enrolled there, and we were trying to find ways to connect them to the community because, as I said, you know, this is our community, you know, our comunidad. And one of the things I think about with AMC is that, you know, what can we be doing again to amplify those voices? But, you know, who helps Joe and who helps others with AMC to really begin thinking about what does programming feel like that doesn't come across as monolithic, right? You know, for example, as much as I would like to see programming that centers around the Latino community, mm-hmm. I want to ensure that it's not being done in a way that is only ascribing to a particular demographic of Latinos, right? Because we do have many who are from Caribbean islands, and what does that mean for Puerto Ricans, and what does that mean for Dominicans? And there are people at times who believe that in promoting, let's say, for example, here, Hispanic, Latin issues, that they may just make assumptions that, you know, well, they must all listen to, you know, Mexican music particularly, right? Or they'll push things that can be seen as societal tropes about a particular demographic. So I'd say is that as a public radio, I do believe WAMC has a responsibility to target and represent all of its listeners. And part of that is to have the conversations with folks like you, Dan, and other folks with Central Civico. I did think LaDon, I know I was in the audience for a moment, but folks from those areas to say, okay, can we have conversations about what that's like? Because we wouldn't want to put WAMC in the position to just make assumptions that, well, we think this is what your listeners would want to hear. And what would that look like? Is it something that's only being done monthly? Is that something that's done weekly? But if those conversations aren't happening, I think it's very hard for public radio to try to get it right. And what I always say is, if we're not invited to that table, my fear is that when it's done, it's probably going to do more harm than good.
Yes.
So I think that there is an opportunity to bring folks together to have that conversation, to help folks at WAMC to try to get it right. And I don't know what that is. All I know is that when I've seen these attempts at trying to reach particular target audiences, my thing is, man, that is not what I asked for. But then I realized no one asked me. And if I were at that table and I had an opportunity to have that conversation, I want to make sure that they're getting it right so that it amplifies my voices.
I Thank you. And I think it's a great question, but I would note that the roundtable has gotten much more diverse in the last year, year and a half. And one of the things that I do in my work, and it's part of my like commitment to DEI, is when I see that there are not Hispanics in a space, I make myself available to that space. So I volunteered. I reached out and said, hey, if you want more voices like mine, I will make myself available for this panel and for the pre-debate panel and for the roundtable, because I do think it's important to have those voices, but we also have to show up, right? And I show up on campus, I show up on work, employment panels, career panels, networking opportunities for young people. I write, I publish, I volunteer. And those are things that we can do. And I recognize we're asking, again, a lot of a small population of people to be the face when not everybody wants to be the face. But there is a lot of opportunity for us, and I think you see a lot of us actually in the public sphere talking about these issues. So to the extent that WAMC has an opportunity to bring more diverse voices, we also have an opportunity to make ourselves available. And I would encourage people who want to hear more voices like yours to be a person who lends their voice to those conversations.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will have our final statements and we will conclude our program from the Linda. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Linda and our DEI panel for this Thursday morning. And thank you so much for listening and being with us. I want to just get to some quick final statements in a moment. But before I do that, just so we don't run out of time, we obviously, these events take a village and it takes a lot of people to bring them together. And I would just like to acknowledge them and thank them for all of their help in putting it together. Amber Sickles, Rob Chacone, Wesley Forster, Mike Bowen, our engineer back at home base, Peter Hughes, Jordan Yoxall, Eddie Hotelling, Nate Scheid, Kayla Sacco, Stacy Rosenberry, and Sarah Gilbert. Big thanks to all of them. Thanks to our board members who are here. I also just want to take a moment. Sarah LeDuc, who is our producer, is not with us today. She is on vacation. Good for her. And because we had to reschedule this event, she unfortunately was unable to be with us. However, you've been hearing her name on the program now, and we have a wonderful associate producer who has come in and is helping us. And she has been running around this week like a total pro and an amazing professional. And I could not be more thrilled that she is with us. And I just hope you'll give a special round of applause to our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. All right. We only have about 30 or 40 seconds for each person, but let's do final statements on what we can take away from this as we leave this morning. Jay.
I hope what people will take away is the understanding the importance behind the concept, right? So we've had a conversation about the language and the change in language and how companies are moving away from that. But the concepts remain essential to the work that we do, whether you are someone who is in a for-profit company that is serving people, that is employing people. The focus on DEI is essential. And if you are in a human services agency, understanding the experience that people are coming into your door seeking service, having this perspective on how to connect with humans is essential. And so I hope that that's the takeaway, that we understand that whatever the politics are going on in the world, that this work is essential.
Kathleen.
DEI is about humanity. And that's what we all are, humans. Take moments to pause, to reflect, to choose. How do you want to show up in the world to be a better human for you and for yourself and your community?
Judy Patrick.
So as much as I love the media and I think we perform an important service in our world, I think I would encourage people to have conversations with their friends and relatives and even strangers on the street to counteract what they're seeing in a negative vein on social media. I think that is a potent way of advancing the conversation.
Nick?
The Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York is a racial justice committed organization, and for me that shows up in every aspect of the work we do, both externally in our service to the community, but also internally to make sure that our employees and our employment has these DEI components woven into every aspect of hiring and employment here. And I think we really need to keep an eye on what workplaces look like and how inclusive and how people belong to those workplace families, if you will. And I appreciate this conversation.
Alfredo.
So for me, what I think I would want for you to take away from this is that the work of DEI, I turn to use the word anti-racism because that really encapsulates everything that we're trying to do here, is to remember that this is a movement, it's not a moment. And sometimes we get caught up in moments of things that are happening around injustices in this world. But in order to reach true liberation means that you're gonna have to be part of this fight forever, as long as you're on this earth. Allow yourself times to recalibrate, to rest, to recover, and to continue that fight with us so that everyone here feels that they are benefiting from what DEI truly is about. And lastly, what I would say is that, you know, take time also for many folks who are here who are grappling with DEI is just to interrogate and try to understand why you have the beliefs that you have. But thank you for having us.
My thanks to everyone. Big hand for the group and to all of you. We'll be back with more Roundtable coming up after this.